Sirat Sohi from The Ringer joins us to answer some questions about round one of the NBA playoffs, including when is it appropriate for Josh Hart to get his candy on? Are dogs good? Where are the Lakers and Sixers right about the referees? And is Max Strus every six games or so just like Michael Jordan? All that and so much more coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. And there's a chance that things will get weird. Yeah, that's a possibility. John Gennaro, count me in! Today's first words belong to Archers of Loaf from their classic cut Web in Front off their 1993 record Icky Metal, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. Easy for me to say. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Number two, public spaces available to all. Madison Square Garden closes its press room 2 hours after post-game interviews wrap up, and I am a slow writer. Shouts out to Jake Fisher for blowing up my spot to all of Twitter about this, which means I had to file my story after last night's batshit Knicks Sixers game two from somewhere outside the arena, and I was able to do it because sometimes public planning and private industry have the foresight to include benches outside of buildings that a person like me can sit on at 1 a.m. Three cheers for the public commons. Shouts out to filing from outside. And number three, nearly as important as all of that, I get to spend part of my day catching up with someone that I've been trying to have on for quite a bit. So I'm very glad we could make it work today. My guest today is a wonderful writer, thinker, and bon vivant, whose work has appeared at SB Nation, Vice Sports, ESPN.com, Rolling Stone, and once upon a time, right here at Yahoo Sports. These days, she is a staff writer at The Ringer, where she covers basketball of all types in all formats with panache, flourish, and aplomb. Friends, a warm welcome for Sirat Sohi. Sirat, thank you so much for making time for us. How are you doing today?
I'm grateful for that introduction. Oh my God. I think I'm ready to run through a wall. Also, I think it's pretty... It's pretty rude that Jake gave you shit after. Can I swear on this podcast? I assume I can swear on this podcast, right?
We'll bleep it all out. It's okay.
Okay. I just can't, like, after a game like that, like, he knows what it's right like to write on deadline. You can't possibly file on time after, you know, a 6-point swing in the last 45 seconds. That's nightmare fuel for any deadline writer.
He does this, and because Jake is a different type of writer than me, right? His coverage is different than mine. He's a reporter first, and he's a, you know, inside information dude. But he has this thing about being like a pro's pro, where it's like, you know, it's 45 minutes after the buzzer and I'm hitting it. And I'm like, I can't do that, dog. I respect the hell out of it. All the things that you can do are things that I can't do, and I respect you for it. My thing is different and it takes a little bit longer, or I'm just slow and I figure it out later. But the point is, that story did go up at Yahoo Sports overnight. It was up for the morning. You can read it today if you would like to. Jake will have more coverage coming as the playoffs go on, as will I and as will we, because... Sirat, I've asked you here today because we're 3 days into the first round of the playoffs. And, you know, like the man said up top, there is not just a chance that things will get weird. It's already gotten weird and it's going to get more so. I feel kind of insane after spending two of the first 3 days on site at Knicks Sixers and then trying to catch up around it with family stuff. So I want someone to help me try to make sense of what I've seen and also what I haven't seen, because I haven't been here for all of it. So you are an omnivorous basketball person. You're very smart and a game mainlining sicko. I know this to be true about you. So I'm very grateful to have you here to get into all of that. And we will get into all of that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So Sirat Sohi, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
You know, despite being down 0-2, the Kyle Lowry floor-burning renaissance, like, you could never make...
We're getting into the CanCon right up top, man. Just Canadian content immediately.
Immediately. Yes. And I also... It had to be a very weird night for Sixers fans as well. I had the foresight to watch last night's games, which were probably the best first round games that I've watched in a really long time, if ever, from a bar, which just enhanced the experience so much. And that can go both ways. Sometimes you're at a bar and they don't turn the sound on. You get lost in conversation. No, I think every part of me was like 10 times more engaged in both of these games because of where I was watching them from. There's a Knicks, I'm in LA and there's a Knicks bar in LA, and it was just the most incredible place to watch those last 45 seconds. That brought me a lot of joy. The Nova boys are just the most fun. I mean, you were in the press conference last night. It just must be hilarious to be covering this team on a somewhat regular basis when one of their players and Josh Hart just takes absolutely nothing seriously. And it's my favorite thing about him. Like, they're just, the three of them are having this press conference, but they're also just kind of talking to each other. And like,
right.
They can communicate so much with a look. You know, they have like 40 inside jokes going that we have no idea about. We won't be privy to until we like watch the roommate show. And so they answer a Twitter question. Lots of reasons to have joy last night.
There's one of my favorite things about that is just you see the different tracks that the players are on. Like Jalen Brunson comes in like immaculate suit, like, you know, tailored to the absolute last centimeter. And Josh Hart comes in like a leather Knicks jacket with and he's taking a box of candy out of his pocket and shaking the candy out into his hand as Jalen Brunson is answering a question about, like, you know, how to deal with different defensive pressures. And he's like, oh, sorry, did I distract you? It's like, this is, yeah, you, whatever we're seeing here is what you are seeing from them in all walks of their life.
And then he kind of looked to the side, and I almost like, you were there, so I have to ask, like, who was he in trouble with? Because he looked to the side and then slowly put the candy away as though somebody was giving him a death stare. Was it Nick's PR? Was it Jalen? Was it you?
It was not me. I mean, Allison, I support, you know, getting your candy on whenever you need to, especially after burning as many calories as Josh Hart burned last night. You know, you got to get that intake back in wherever you can as quickly as possible. Jalen definitely looked over at him like, come on, man. Like, I'm trying to just like this person's asking a question about defensive coverages, and I'm trying to think about how I want to answer this. And you're just like shaking, as like being in a movie theater and someone rattling the box of Good and Plenty or whatever. It might also have been Nick's PR, because the Nick's PR right off to the side of the podium there. And you're absolutely right to point to those last 45 seconds, obviously. But like, that could, there was a lot of joy in that building last night, and it could have been absolutely the diametrically opposed emotions in that situation, because it's a 5-point deficit with, I think, 30 seconds to go or something like that. And that would have been disastrous, you know, for the Knicks to come out of those two games where Joel Embiid is like dragging his leg around. Tyrese Maxey was questionable with an illness that he said after the game. Had left him like cold chills, pain, like not even really able to move very much Sunday night. And then the Sixers are getting nothing from basically anybody else on the floor. To come out of that series at 1-1, to come out of that situation without being up 2-0 would have been disastrous. And then, you know, miracles happen. So super weird night. I think watching it at a bar sounds like the right move, because honestly, if I could have had a stiff drink sitting there on press row, I might have taken it.
Yeah, it was definitely, I think the stiff drink was actually much more necessary after the Jamal Murray shot, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But yeah, and it's also, I mean, I also wonder, like, are we seeing a generational curse get excised? Because after the game, I was just, you know, trolling around on YouTube, listening to press conferences and things like that. And I decided to go back and watch the Reggie Miller 8 points in 9 seconds. And it happened in a very similar fashion with these gaffes that I think, like, you just don't really ever assume will happen in a playoff game, but they did. And there was a timeout that was never seen by the referee that Nick Nurse referenced and was rightfully irate about. I think, like, the reffing became a storyline from both nights, and I think the Sixers are much more justified in their anger, and there's a lot more correlation between the result and a bad or non-call in that situation than I think there was for a bad third quarter overturn call on D'Angelo Russell. But there was that. But then also, I just feel like as much as the Knicks found, or the Sixers rather, found a way to offset the Knicks' offensive rebounding issues, I think this is just going to be a series-long problem, because the other thing that happened in that sequence on the first play, or no, on the second play, God.
I know it's hard to pick through everything that was going on there.
But Joel Embiid didn't box out on Isaiah Hartenstein on the Dante DiVincenzo, the second three-pointer that he got. I also love the note from Dante that The Knicks always practice for those situations. Like, they scramble and practice for an offensive rebound turning into a three in a crunch time situation, which is just such a beautiful amalgamation of what a Tom Thibodeau team is. Just a mix of strategy, effort, and the assumption that it will get you a shot like that. Just beautiful stuff.
Yeah, when he said that, and after listening to Tibbs in a few, pre and post game pressers, there's the feeling of like Littlefinger in Game of Thrones being like, if you are always at war with everyone constantly and always thinking about what they're going to do to you all the time, then you can't be caught by surprise. I'm like, yeah, but that also makes you insane, right? And it's like, well, hi, I'm Tom Thibodeau. Nice to meet you. And all the players saying like, yeah, that's why we play for him. We want to run through a brick wall for him because you are never out. You've never feel like you're out of it because, not because he's some like grand genius as far as creative play calling, but like you are prepared for whatever the hardest thing to do is in that moment. And that, you know, your mileage may vary on that. But in that moment, one team was ready to go to the glass. One team was ready to relocate for shots. One team was ready to understand what the, you know, like where they needed to get to on the floor. And it wasn't the Sixers. And that's like the margins at this time of year are vanishingly thin. And yes, the refereeing is part of it. We will actually get back to that in a minute. But you said you were trolling around on YouTube looking at, first of all, you said Reggie Miller, and we're not going to do that on this show because I'm trying to help myself on this show. So we're not going to get into Reggie Miller today, but
today might be the day though. Today might be the day. Like you don't think there's enough of a shine now. Like I think, since this is a self-help podcast, right? So
it is.
Most of the time when you are trying to process some level of trauma, to be able to do it in a situation where you feel safe is the best way. I don't think you could possibly feel safer. And it seems we got some karmic retribution. So if there ever was a time, I don't know.
I hear you, Sarah, but it's the second game of the first round. So I don't feel very safe right now. But but I do appreciate what you're saying. You mentioned just sort of being able to go through the press conferences, and that's like kind of what our framing device is for today's discussion. I find myself doing, obviously I was at the games. And so when the game ends, you rush down to the interview room or the locker room to try to get position and be able to ask questions, listen to the interviews. If you're not, maybe you go over to YouTube or you pull up NBA TV or whatever, and you listen to what the coaches have to say. This is a time of year for like press conference watching. And if you listen long enough, you realize that a lot of the players and coaches say a lot of the same things. So as a way to kind of get our arms around the happenings of these first few days, I wanted to hand out some playoff cliche awards in a variety of categories. We'll get through the categories and sort of explain what they mean. I will grant that this premise is a little bit sweaty, but then again, this is like a sweaty premise podcast, like a fake self-help podcast about basketball. So some of that's baked in and we're just going to have to go with it. You okay with that, Sarah?
Yeah, we got to lean in.
Absolutely. But nevertheless, we move. First up on our list today, he's got that dog in him. Which player had the most forceful individual performance of the opening 3 days? Sirat, who jumped off the page for you there?
Oh, Ant. Obviously, absolutely. Ant, right? Yeah. There's no question. I mean, honorable mention to J-Dub, a.k.a. J-Dog, ow, himself.
What wonderful barks. Fantastic barks.
Incredible. Yeah. Incredible. It's my favorite bit of the entire season. There was a point where the Thunder sideline reporter also got in on it. I don't think Shea was as in on it. Shea is probably has the most stoic demeanor on that team.
Yes.
He eventually even caved. I did it on a podcast into a microphone just now. we're all in. Total aside, but you're in New York. The cut essay on anti-dog backlash that's happening.
Yeah.
Do you have a dog and do you have thoughts on that?
So I do not
going in a just
totally, totally fine. I do not currently have a dog. Longtime listeners will know Luger, the premium boy, crossed the Rainbow Bridge not too long ago around the holidays. But the kids are it's all good. The kid, we're talking about processed unresolved trauma. We're working through the Luger stuff here. There's a box of ashes like out that room. The kids are on me about when we're getting another one because they're ready for it. Because, yeah, we have become a family that's sort of into the, bow, bow, wow, woof, woof, woof. And but the cut essay, I'll be honest with you. I saw the backlash. I think the backlash to the backlash. I don't think that I even got like the front lash for the cut essay. I'm not exactly sure. I know that. Walk me through it. The premise is people shouldn't have dogs?
The premise is that around COVID, people all got dogs, and some people that got dogs didn't do the best job at training their dogs and didn't necessarily fully consider the responsibility that you take on when you get a dog. And there seems to be some entitlement with dog owners, just a sense of like, you know, it might not be an off-leash area, but a dog is off their leash. Maybe they are peeing into people's planters. And, you know, I think we had this moment where dogs could do absolutely no wrong. But now I think we're getting to this other, you know, we've crossed this threshold where it seems like, I don't know, it's like this is something that I read online, which is why I wanted to ask somebody on the ground, where maybe dogs have taken up too much public space, too much space that should actually maybe be intended for children, for example, in, you know, taking over parks that aren't necessarily dog parks. And it's also some like just really, really like, you know, borderline tragic stuff where like you got dogs attacking toddlers and, you know, the dog owner is just as traumatized as I was going to say kid owner, but that doesn't sound right, as a parent.
I mean, so listen, sometimes it can be difficult to distinguish in terms of what the responsibilities are. They're not wildly dissimilar. Yeah, I would say my on the ground reporting on that is like, people can be a little loose with off leash and where I live, but it's not super bad. And I don't think it's, I think that feels a little bit, I'm also in the not cool part of Brooklyn. So maybe I'm not getting the same access to the same sort of city street sidewalk issues that the cut authors or readers are particularly focused on. So it's not a major problem right where I am. Maybe the answer is just everybody needs a Mark Dagnall, you know, somebody who really knows how to organize those dogs.
I agree. I think that was a great segue, by the way. I guess so. Ant is actually who we were talking about. Or who
yeah, but Jimmy, J-Dub is a great answer too.
They're both, I mean, they're both like, yeah, there's been a number of guys. But I mean, you got to give it to him, man. Also, just like the trash talking of Kevin Durant afterwards was just one of the great, you know, rite of passage moments that we've had in the postseason so far. And that's kind of the story of this one, right? Like, of the old guys, who is going to be able to have the stamina to be able to keep up and who is going to be ready for prime time. And I think, you know, the Thunder and the T-Wolves kind of both prove that they are ready for this moment.
Absolutely. And with Ant was, I mean, a pretty easy choice on my end too, where, you know, 18 points on 8 of 11 shooting in that third quarter, finishes with a game high 33, also had like a pretty big role in keeping Brad Beal quiet, which is a big part of Phoenix's offense and what they can get him with his rim pressure and downhill aggression. If Ant's able to minimize him, sort of chops a leg out from a Phoenix offense that had been really dominant against Minnesota throughout the season. And that was like, it's seeing a guy sort of download what you're doing to him. And the Suns had a ton of success during the regular season with showing like super aggressive help at Ant, basically like building almost like a Giannis in transition wall. Like there's three guys on the ball, like almost every time Ant faced up, because they were just like, we are going to dare Kyle Anderson, dare Jalen McDaniels, like dare everybody else to beat us. And Ant just sort of turned that to ash, like absolutely, you know, tore it apart. And so there's a fun part of that where it's also like, and seeing the rhythm of a game come like that together, a couple of buckets in transition to get started, getting off the ball and getting it back. And then like, all right, now I'm just taking turns dialing up. Okay, it's Brad Beal this time. It's Grayson Allen that time, like dialing up everybody and saying, I'm just going to torch you until you get to KD, which, yes, is like the most memeable moment of the opening round. And also it's what you want. It's like, you want someone to take the challenge. I know Vinny Goodwill has talked about this. He wrote about it for Yahoo Sports, and then he talked about it on The Good Word. Like, you want guys to take that challenge and say, like, I'm going to snatch the torch. I'm not just going to, you know, like, wait for you to age out. And, like, for Ant to be that sort of joy, it was a confident and composed performance. Turnovers are a little bit of an issue, but that's going to be part of it, baked into the amount he's creating. But it's also, like, loud and brash and joyous. Like, I don't know what more you could want.
It's also, I mean, you know, you definitely, like, turnovers are part of it, but I also love the way that he navigated the game. I think most of his turnovers were in the early juncture where he was really just trying to spray the ball everywhere. And I think he came out in that third quarter and he was like, okay, I guess this is the coverage. these guys have decided that they are going to wall off the rim and they are basically going to dare me to shoot mid-range jumpers in the middle. I have to operate in that mid-post area and beat them from there. Like, just a acceptance of that type of concession being made by the defense and just going with it, I think can be tricky sometimes, but I love the way that he navigated it. And it's also, it's a major growth point for him from last playoffs and throughout this season as well. So then he also is so good in that area. And it's also like the most fun place, other than obviously when he's dunking, to watch him operate, because he gets really creative. He'll do these, like, he'll like spin out into a fadeaway, and he has the touch and the athleticism to basically, you know, he can be in midair and find his footing and square up to the rim and hit incredible shots. And after a while, the Suns were like, oh, okay, I guess we aren't doing that anymore. Then you start seeing some soft hedges, some traps, and he immediately gets the ball out of his hands right away and starts setting guys up for three. He takes a few threes of his own, but just to see him be able to play the chess game on that level and not need it to go to game two, I think that's key. To be able to come out at halftime and make that adjustment, as opposed to needing to, you know, go over, watch the tape, then understand what you need to do, by at which point Phoenix is probably going to come at you with a different game plan in game two anyways, regardless of whether it works. It's playoff basketball. Like, you always add a few new wrinkles regardless. So yeah, it was an incredible performance.
Two thoughts with that. Just the adjustments game one to game two. I think I saw Frank Vogel when he was asked sort of, you know, how do you adjust your tactics, being like, I'm not going to tell you, like, I'm not going to give the Timberwolves what our game plan is. And it's like, fair enough, Frank. But then the worry there a little bit is like, no, I have like a double secret game plan. And that's really what's going to turn the tide for us. Like, the more you say, like, I'm not going to tell you, the more I'm like a little bit worried you might not have anything in the folder. And then the second thing was just watching it back. There, when Ant, it was in the third quarter, he's going up on Booker and he has like a step through that he gets to like a running righty hook, and just hearing Hubie Brown go like, ah, like he was like the proudest pop in that moment. He was just like, because it wasn't even a there you go. Like, Hubie so often is like, there you go. But it's like, it's just, ah, and it made me so happy to hear, like, Hubie, again, we
involuntarily wheezing out of delight.
yeah, exactly. You can't control how happy you are in that moment, and then the way that it expresses itself, and that was a font of joy. I want to come back to something that you brought up earlier with another cliche that we've got here. This one, I have to admit, the framing of it comes from super producer John Gennaro, and I love it. It's the Ayesha Curry quote, "I've lost all respect. Sorry, this is absolutely rigged for money or ratings. I'm not sure. I won't be silent. Just saw it live. Sorry." I'm not sure that's a cliche, but it is certainly a notable quote. Players and teams complaining too much about the refs. You mentioned earlier the conversation stemming from both Lakers, Nuggets, and Knicks, Sixers. I didn't see the Lakers Nuggets game live, so maybe you can tell me, like, how valid do you think their point of view coming out after the game was here? I know that both, you know, D'Angelo Russell had comments and Anthony Davis had comments. LeBron dropped the mic about it. From where you were sitting in that lovely sports bar watching, how much of a case do you think that they had about that?
So dropping the mic, that's an interesting point. I think in both press conferences with Darvin Ham and with LeBron, neither of them were actually asked about the referees, but they brought up the referees on their own accord. With that LeBron one, it wasn't necessarily drop the mic. He knew it was going to be the last question. You could hear it from the PR saying it. So he made sure he added it on top of whatever the last question was.
Okay.
Which, and the fact that it wasn't a question that was asked only speaks to me about the fact that it wasn't that big of a story. It wasn't like this. It wasn't the first, second, or third reason that the Lakers lost. It was one play. I think from the NBA's perspective, to have a replay review be that egregious, to have, you know, the refs look bad on 3D from multiple angles, is a more interesting story. Because, you know, it does get to the point of, it was a bad call, and why do you have replay review if you are going to overturn things that were just blatantly obvious? I mean, D'Angelo Russell did get hit in the face. At the same time, the Lakers had a 20-point lead in the third quarter. They had a 10-point lead going into the fourth quarter. They should have won that game. I'm still, frankly, trying to understand how they didn't win that game. You had Anthony Davis have the offensive performance of his life. You had LeBron James taking over in the fourth quarter. You had D'Angelo Russell opening the game with three made triples and, you know, just him finding his rhythm. You had a bad Jamal Murray shooting game. You had a third quarter where even as the Nuggets are making a comeback and you're watching it sort of happen like a slow motion car crash and you're just wishing Darvin Ham would just do something finally. And he, you know, in classic Darvin Ham fashion, kind of doesn't, is just the Nuggets through that stretch. They're missing a ton of wide open threes or open threes that are just rimming out. The Nuggets don't do that on a consistent basis. You don't have Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Jamal Murray missing all of their threes on a consistent basis. And then to take it back to the refereeing issue, you had with 57 seconds left in the game, Jamal Murray gets free throws on LeBron on a pretty questionable call. It could have gone either way. I think, you know, LeBron kind of shoved him a little bit, but it was, you know, if we're having the type of night where that call on D'Angelo Russell can get overturned, maybe you use one of your two timeouts to challenge the call if you are that upset about the refereeing. Like, you did have control over that situation in that particular moment. So, yeah, I mean, the refs, yeah, there's bad call. I think the Sixers have a lot more reason, a lot more justification to be upset. I don't see it from the Lakers side. It felt like skirting accountability to me, frankly.
And, you know, at a certain point, if you're like, when you have the facts, you bang the facts, and when you don't have the facts, you bang the table a little bit. Like the idea of, you know, you reach a point where it's 10 straight to this same team. You are in the like exact situation to be able to come out on top of that, where you have the great start and the great, you know, you build up the big lead and then just get walked down. And there is a certain level, like I'm a Anthony Davis defense respecter. You know, I had him on my defensive player of the year ballot this year, much to the chagrin of all of South Texas, which I was like, oh, it's nice to have the Spurs fans back. Good. All right. I haven't talked to you guys in a little while. You are not thrilled with me. Then to have it go from that to the story, he talks to Dave McMenamin at ESPN and it's like, I'm never going to get it. They don't like me. It's just, this is what it is. And then the immediate aftermath of it is 27, 20 and 10 for Jokic. And then in the final possession of the game, Murray over the top of him, where it's like, all right, maybe this is a not so much karmic balance, but a little bit of like, I don't know. If you don't have the answers for that, then maybe don't pipe up about how you deserve more. I don't know. It's a difficult set of circumstances, and it's certainly where they go in game three. I'll be fascinated to find out. The Sixers' point of it, as you mentioned, they have a maybe more valid gripe, and they are certainly going to raise it. We found out last night, I think Tim Bontemps was the first to put it out there, that the Sixers intend to file a complaint with the NBA about the officiating games 1 and 2 of the series, file a grievance. He firmly officially termed a grievance, according to a team spokesperson, Kyle Newbeck at, I don't know how to pronounce it, PHLY, Fly, Philly Sports, all Philly Sports, the All City Network, the Philly one. Kyle, shouts out to you. Good to see you this weekend. The laundry list of concerns they want to present to the league include, but are not limited to, the Sixers being disadvantaged by two calls in the last 2 minutes report from game one, incorrect no call on a foul by Mitchell Robinson, incorrect no call on a traveling violation on Jalen Brunson, Nick Nurse calling for a timeout twice and not getting it. And, you know, he talked about that after the game. Joel Embiid was very adamant. Everybody on the floor in a Sixers uniform was calling for a timeout. They didn't get one. And this is the one that makes you sort of cringe a little bit. Quote, this is from Kyle Newbeck's story. The Sixers have been the most disadvantaged team in the last 2 minute report this season. A report compiled in early April showed that the Sixers had been disadvantaged on 22 calls in these reports during the regular season, compared to 11 such errors going against opposing teams, the worst such ratio in the NBA. This all has sort of big Daryl Morey energy, which I don't love. I, again, Daryl Morey respecter generally here, but there always seems to be an audit when the team doesn't win the game. And I think you could certainly make a legitimate argument. There could have been fouls called on the inbounds pass with Tyrese Maxey last night. Tyrese Maxey took the high road the entire way, by the way, and the presser was just like, I got to be better. I can't lose the ball. I got to hold on to it. I tried to grab it, did, you know, tried my best. I got to be better. Everybody else was like, he got hacked. The timeout, you know, that's a, one of the, another one of those, like, depending on which frame of the replay you pause on, it's, is the ball in his hands? Is Nick Nurse actually making the signal? Did he try to put his hands together and then not? Should he have run out onto the court to get attention? Whatever. Which lens you view that through probably depends on which laundry you're rooting for. But I would say, generally speaking, if the outcome of this is we lost a 5-point lead in 30 seconds and it's the ref's fault, I think that's a kind of a tough pill to swallow. And then you're filing a grievance to what end? I don't know. Like, I think that there's a reasonable argument to be made there, but I just don't know where it goes. Like for what, for who at this point?
It feels, I mean, it all has to be gamesmanship at this point. Like, you're not going to overturn the result of a playoff game.
Yeah. It's not like the grievance is going to be like, actually now it's 1-1. Good job.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I think it's all for the future. I think it's all, and I think the same thing goes for the Lakers too. Like, I think we're going to see a couple of game threes coming up here where the home team shoots 24 to 25 free throws at least. And we are going to see a game plan where LeBron James is taking it at the rim. Joel Embiid is taking it at the rim. Anthony Davis is taking it at the rim. We might see some early foul trouble for certain Knicks players, certain Denver players. It's all about the future to me. I think, yes, the way that the Sixers went about it was very, very dramatic. It felt like, you know, they had like Deloitte on their chair for this. Like, they had somebody helping them out. But yeah, I mean, the other thing too with that game is, I hate to say this as a Kyle Lowry stan, you're the oldest player in that situation. You're the one inbounding the ball. I do think Nick Nurse tried to get a timeout before Kyle inbounded the ball too, which is the one that I think there's a more justification for. Once the ball was inbounds, you don't really like this. They didn't have possession, to me, in my opinion. Yeah, he was probably hit, but that's also not really something you can litigate in the moment. If you don't have possession, you don't have possession. I needed the timeout there. You also had Joel Embiid pretty open on that play while Maxey's getting chased by two guys as well. And you also, I just think you need to have an anchor. You need to have an anchor in moments like that. Like, there are certain teams, like, you always see, like the Nuggets, for example, they don't lose on those types of plays because, worst case scenario, Jokic just posts somebody up 10 feet from the rim and makes it an easy catch. And you have a guy in Joel Embiid who can do that for you. And frankly, like, this is postseason basketball. You need to execute on the fly, and there's no going back, you know, like, you have to live with these moments and you have to move on. You just have to be better the next game.
It's so, Embiid is, I'm realizing the more I watch him live, it's almost impossible to tell how damaged he is and at what percentile he is operating, because he was dragging that left leg around the entire second half. He, you know, our friend Tom Haberstroh had noted, like, I think there was like 7 or 8 straight possessions where he didn't even get inside the 3-point line because he just, you know, could not get it going. And then, you know, there's moments where he's euro stepping and taking contact and getting to the, or diving for a loose ball to save possession. And he puts up 34 and 10, and he's like, and he still is like a force field around the rim. And then you get into the post-game press conference and he's like, it's ice bags everywhere. And his head is down with dark sunglasses on. And you're like, I don't know if you are figuring out what exactly he's able to do, right? Like, where you can forgive and say, like, well, maybe he's not boxing out Hartenstein or being that post up and saying, get it to me, because he's worried about the leg or he can't really move around that much. It's like, yeah, but this is this is when you have to be able to do that stuff. And if you can't do it, then you can't be out there. But then if he's not out there, then they have no shot. So it is a lot going on for sure. And it's being, I think, hanging it on calls at the end misses a larger context. But I also, like, if I was a Sixers fan watching the game, or if I was on the Sixers bench watching that game and watching the way it wrapped up, I would certainly understand the frustration and maybe want somebody to file a grievance on my behalf.
Yeah, you get it. And you also could kind of feel, I think, you know, when he fell in game 1-2 and his eye was twitching, and you could feel like maybe he was maybe he was tearing up. I don't can't say that 100% for sure. But also after that game, too, I feel like you can start to just feel how much the weight of his history with the Sixers is just starting. It feels like it's starting to crush him a little bit. It feels like the injuries and everything else that's happened on the Sixers team that has had, like, I just started thinking about it last night. You know, like, you have the Ben Simmons game seven. You have the Kawhi shot, and then you also have a Jalen Brunson shot that, you know, hits the front of the rim and goes in, and it's just like, God, like, God, like, do you really, really need to, like, bring back war flashbacks in a moment like this at the same time?
Former Divine Intervention guest and stand-up comedian Josh Gondelman called that the acoustic cover of the Kawhi shot, just like the one bounce all the way up and then coming down through. Yeah, absolutely brutal, and, like, nope. Every fan base and every franchise is its own unique special snowflake, but there's nobody that's got the kind of the laundry list of trauma, the medical jacket, the specific unique weirdnesses that the Sixers do. And so much of it has sort of persisted throughout Embiid's career. It's wild. I think we got time for maybe one more cliche before we need to move. But so I'm going to give you a choice. Would you prefer to do, we liked the looks we got, they came out more aggressive, or we got some stuff, we got to watch the film and get that cleaned up? Which of those cliches do you think that you would like to hit?
I think I need you to pick.
All right. I'm going to go with nobody believes in us, which is the general idea is, like, which player team do you lack confidence in despite their early playoff success? And I'm sorry, I'm going to be a hater here a little bit, but I think this is the Cavs for me. It's not that I think that I don't believe in them to finish off the Magic, although I had picked the Magic before the series because I did not love the energy of the way the Cavs ended the season and then also maneuvering into the 4-5 matchup. But they go up 2-0. They have not trailed in the series. Like, credit to them. They found the matchup they wanted and they have performed well in it. You know, Donovan Mitchell has a little bit more burst than he had previously. He's dunked twice in the series after dunking only once since the All-Star break, which is kind of a good deal. You know, you sort of zoom out a little bit and it's, yeah, they've been better on the defensive glass, which is huge considering that was such a huge problem with them against the Knicks last year. But the starting lineup is still, like, barely net positive against a Magic team that just can't score. They're winning the Mobley and Allen minutes, but they're scoring 1 point per possession to do it. And that's not going to be a sustainable recipe for success, I don't think. Max Strus and George Niang, who were, like, they were the answer to the question of how do we space the floor better for our guys, are 2-for-18 combined from three in these first couple of games. And, you know, Donovan, as much as he's looked better with his burst, still 5-for-18 from deep, but doesn't seem to have his touch there. And, like, even when you get past that, on the other side is Boston, right? So they've won 2 games, which is all you can ask for. I guess I'm the nobody believes in this guy on them because I'm like, I don't know that you fundamentally changed or resolved the questions we had about you. I don't know that these 2 wins or even 4 wins in this series is going to do it. But I guess there's still something to be said for just, like, winning a series. They have not done that. So there's something to be said for that. But it's still, I find myself coming away from it a little bit cold.
I'm ready to buy some stock in the Cavs.
And tell me why.
I've been in this position of, you know, 1 foot in the door, 1 foot out for most of the season. Because to your point, it has been so up and down. And the way that they were playing, not only just Mitchell's injury, but the sort of vibes that seem to emanate from that, just looks so bad that going into the postseason, I was like, okay, I can't. This isn't the time to unfurl this deep-seated but, like, hidden belief I have in this Cleveland team. So to me, I think some of their problems are things that just have really simple solutions. Like, yes, I don't like their starting lineup. I think there's a reason that their best stretch this season came when there were a number of injuries. I think they just looked like a team that made a lot more sense when Garland was out and when Mobley was out because, you know, it allows just, like, a clean pick and roll game with, you know, Donovan Mitchell, one of the best guys in the league at that, and Jarrett Allen rolling to the rim, bunch of shooters. I'm not really worried about Niang and Max Strus not hitting their shots going down the line. To me, that's just, like, almost more encouraging. Like, okay, you're beating the brakes off of the Magic, and Max Strus is, like, every 6 games he's like fucking Michael Jordan. So I'm not stressed about Max Strus ever. And I think he's one of those guys that, like, he brings that element that they were missing against the Knicks last year. I also, you know, they were a team that was very open about the fact that, you know, like, the famous Jarrett Allen Bleacher Report cut now of like the lights were too bright. I don't think it's a bad thing to admit that. If anything, you know, I covered a Raptors team pre-Kawhi for years that just pretended that they never had any issues with the spotlight in the playoffs. And it was always an X's and O's thing. And like, they were just on the line. And it was, I think, they were never really talented enough to get past LeBron anyway, but they also always shrunk in the postseason. And I think part of that had to do with the fact that they got tagged with this reputation that they were never really willing to fully own, that they deserved it. And I think that I respect that Cleveland, because it wasn't just Allen, it was everybody, and it came out and said, yeah, that wasn't okay. Like, we were not good. I would much rather have that than to see you do that and then pretend it was X's and O's.
Right.
I also think that the weirdness of their starting lineup is due to the fact that they have a lot of variability in what they are able to do. And my biggest thing with them is, like, will they figure out the right rotations at the right time? And I think I've seen moments in this season where Bickerstaff has. I've seen moments this season where he hasn't. But your finishing lineup does not have to be your starting lineup. And I think at a certain point, the rubber hits the road, and maybe you just say, okay, Evan Mobley, you got to go to the bench right now. But for now, I also, you know, you compare it to a team like the Knicks. I look at one of the biggest problems the Knicks are having right now is that Jalen Brunson is like their only creator. So with Garland and Mitchell, you have a problem, but you have one of those good problems in that sometimes the lineup that gives you your best net rating is also the easiest one to flatten out at the same time. So there's 40,000 reasons not to believe in Cleveland, but I think, you know, they've got one of the few lineups that I think can deal with Boston going 5-0, for example. They're going to have enough shot creation between Mitchell and Garland if they stagger those correctly. I love Max Strus. I think he's one of the best Jason Tatum defenders in the NBA. Like, and you know, you can get freaky with some stuff. Like, let's get 10 minutes of like Mitchell and Sam Merrill running pick and pops when, you know, Boston's defense just finds a way to, you know, crush everything else. So yeah, I like Cleveland. I've liked them all season. I've probably liked them more than everybody else. And generally that usually means that I'm wrong, but I'm going to ride with them.
No, I think there's something to be said for standing up for your convictions. And also, as I say, I'm not a believer, like, momentary shout out to Isaac Okoro, who was basically like the avatar for all the things that weren't working with the Cavs last year in the playoffs, where it's like, he's the reason you can sag off. He's the reason you can't, like, you know, the lottery pick that you can't keep on the floor when it matters, and who has made tangible, significant improvements to his game to make himself into somebody who, at least through the first couple of games of this series against an elite defensive team, has been able to stay on the floor, has been able to make an impact, and, you know, create a little bit more for them going around. So do you have a nobody believes in me team?
I do have to add, I don't think that means they're going to beat Boston. I don't think anybody is going to beat Boston. Right. I just don't see a reason.
Belief is a wonderful thing, but it has
in Philly or New York.
Belief is a wonderful thing, but it has its limits. I think that's fair.
Exactly. So the nobody believes in us team is a team that you don't believe in, that I personally don't believe in.
Well, just they've had some success, you know, they're early on here, but you lack some confidence in them.
Milwaukee. I'm like, okay. And maybe that's not, it kind of came into the postseason not really giving you any reasons to believe. But I mean, yeah, I think they're, as far as what their ambitions are, I don't think that beating a Pacers team in game one, that frankly, like, I just don't really understand some of the narrative around the Pacers after the Siakam trade. I think that they don't know who they are anymore. They haven't known who they are since the trade. They've made some offense for defense concessions that I think long term are going to be good for them. But within the scope of the regular season, they were just never able to figure out how to make this new configuration work. I love Andrew Nembhard, fellow Canadian. Tyrese Haliburton obviously has been hurt. But this lineup, like, you lose, I mean, losing Buddy Hield, who's, by the way, like, gone to Philadelphia and completely forgotten everything that makes him good at basketball, is, I think, a bigger deal than
everybody lost the Buddy Hield trade.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Like, he would have been so much better off just staying in Indiana. But that was, you know, that him and Tyrese were kind of the engine of their fast break. And I think Siakam, for as much as he has a reputation for being a guy who plays fast, the last few years of his career has become much more of a half court player. He's getting older. He's not, doesn't want to run the floor all the time. And you can see that he also is a guy that like has a habit, as we saw in that first game, of like, if you give him the mid-range jumper on the step, like, he's just going to take it. Like, he feels good about that shot, and I don't think he should feel as good about it as he does sometimes. And, you know, granted, the Pacers needed a little bit more dynamism, and they needed that shot creation, but they haven't found a way to make it all work together. And now with their starting lineup just doesn't have enough spacing for an effective Tyrese Haliburton Siakam two-man game, especially if Haliburton's going to be hampered. You got Nembhard in there, who's just kind of like, his shooting is not the same as it was the season before. Turner is a great floor spacer at the five, but at the five, you know, like, it's just, you're still going to live with him. It's kind of like the problem that the Pelicans have with Jonas Valanciunas. Like, yeah, like, he can hit some three sometimes, but like, am I ever going to not guard Zion Williamson or Brandon Ingram, right, because I'm scared of Jonas Valanciunas? Like, it's kind of the same issue. So yeah, like, I think Milwaukee should beat Indiana, and I still doesn't make me any more confident in their ability to have a deep postseason run.
Yeah, I mean, even, and obviously the biggest question hanging over that is the health of Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is continued to rule, they've listed him as doubtful with the calf strain for game two, which is the same designation he had before game one, before they ruled him out, and, you know, TBD on when you're actually going to see him again. For the record, for what it's worth, Amin El Hassan visited the Good Word with Fit Goodwill with Vinny and predicted that the Bucks would be in the Eastern Conference Finals. So one of y'all's got to be wrong, but we're going to find out which one.
It's usually me, if it's between me and Amin.
I don't know. It could be. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But we're going to take a quick break here to pay some bills, and we will be right back with some more Divine Intervention. Welcome back to Divine Intervention. Guest here is Sirat Sohi from The Ringer. And we're going to move on to something that we call the closing five, because as you mentioned earlier, your starting lineup does not have to be the same as your closing lineup. And how you finish is much more important than how you start. Five questions for our illustrious guest. Here we go. Question one. In a 2020 article that you wrote for a fine website called Yahoo Sports, you quoted LeBron James as saying, "I think if you line 27-year-old LeBron up with 35-year-old LeBron, the elder would dominate him." What would the current version of Sirat Sohi dominate the younger version of Sirat Sohi at?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, you get older, you just sort of, like, you understand yourself a little bit better. You understand your strengths and your limitations, much like LeBron James. I've always...
you are the LeBron James of Sirat Sohis. I've always said that about you.
I would hope. I don't think that there's too many of us out there. So, like, I better be. I think just getting older, you know, like, there's certain, like, movement is not quite what it used to be, but you understand that, you accept those things, and you just learn to live with that. Like, I sleep better now because I know I need it, for example.
I love that. The current version of Sirat would dominate the previous version of Sirat at sleeping. I love that as an answer. It's you're thinking the game, and I respect that. I respect that about you. What's terrible about me is that I was better at sleeping when I was younger. I'm getting worse, I think. And so I, like, as every time I see myself back on the camera here, I'm constantly with a cup of coffee. And it's, no matter when we are recording, no matter what I'm doing, always a cup of coffee, because I don't treat myself very well, which I got to work on. Question two, you are originally from Edmonton, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the question. You now live in Los Angeles. What thing about Canada do you miss the most?
Oilers games, probably. I'm only saying that today because the Oilers just beat the LA Kings roundly in game one of the Stanley Cup playoffs. Also, I mean, I miss my family. I miss my people. I don't miss the snow.
I love that they come in second.
Yeah, I mean, Frank, I don't even, I'm going to be honest, I don't watch the Oilers a lot, but this was just for anybody from LA who was listening. I just wanted to...
Right, run up and get done up. It's playoff time. Yeah. You got to understand that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But, you know, I mean, LA is a lovely place. I like it a lot. But that's another thing, I think, with getting older, too, is, like, you just start to realize what's actually important to you. And, your parents start getting a little bit older. friends start having kids and you're just like, wow, things are happening. It's not like things aren't really where you leave them anymore.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They've moved to different spots while mm-hmm. you were away. And yeah, I mean, you can't go and you can't take those kids to the kid park and watch them play with the other kid owners. It's a little bit tough.
They can though. They can come here and come to Universal Studios though, which is only like
that's
20
true.
Minutes from me. So.
Which is huge. We are after the playoffs and after the finals and after free agency, the Divine Family will be doing a West Coast trip. And so they're planning kid things along the way will be part of it. And so whatever whatever our kid friendly versions of things along the way are going to be, we're going to have to figure some of that out. So I look forward to it. Sub question, actually, off question number two. Do you want to take a minute to just freak the fuck out about SGA and Murray hitting game winners on consecutive nights as just CanCon? Let's get it all going here.
I mean, there's no need to, because I knew it was going to happen. There's no moment when Jamal Murray was dribbling the ball up the floor and they weren't calling a timeout. And then D'Angelo Russell does like the most regular season hedge of all time. just to give Anthony Davis a little bit of cover here, that you weren't like, oh, Jamal Murray's going to hit this game winner right now. Like, it just doesn't matter with him. He's like, he's such a killer. And you know, SGA, same deal. I don't know. Like, I'm not shocked at any of those things. I'm happy about them. To be sure. But those are both players that I expect it from at this point.
Can I admit maybe a bit of immaturity on my part? As SGA was going through that fourth quarter and it was nip and tuck there and they had a couple of rocky turnovers and things weren't looking so good, I was typing in looking shaky. S-H-A-I-K.
Wow.
And then I held on to it. I checked the swing because mm-hmm. I was like, in a minute, he might hit two shots and make me look like a fucking idiot. And then guess what he did is precisely that. So, but I didn't look like an idiot at the time. Only on my own show do I admit to being an idiot about it for the purposes of perhaps getting a few laughs off.
Also, shout out to the New Orleans Pelicans who just can't figure out their crunch time offense.
And it's like they're so like I've we've talked about them a bunch on this show. I have a relationship to that franchise that someone explained to me where it's like, oh yeah, they're like the Western Conference Knicks, and I'm like, oh right, that's why I feel damaged by them. Okay, why I'm fascinated and interested by them. Like there's so much to like, and then like the 5% that isn't figured out is like always gonna. Absolutely stuck a dagger into their gut when it matters most. And I don't know, man. Earlier when we were talking about, you know, postseason newcomers and guys who were impressed, like Trey Murphy is going to need to start immediately. And I don't know I think the cleanest path to resolving that is going to be to trade Brandon Ingram, but I don't know how you do that and what you get back from him this summer. And also, how do you do that while Zion can't play? Because, you know, well, there's a lot to figure out. I know also Sirot wrote a wonderful piece about the Zion Williamson issue and some of the roster building things that go along with it after he went down. So go read that at theringer.com. Question number three. You recently said when discussing WNBA legend Diana Taurasi that you, quote, love a shit-eating grin, motherfucker. We also love them around here and we want some more reasons to get people into the WNBA. So what makes Diana Taurasi one of those? And are there some other folks among the WNBA player population you might describe similarly?
So Diana Taurasi, there were a number of WNBA players recently who were tweeting their welcome to the WNBA moments. So many of those were delivered by the hands of Diana Taurasi, who also in 2020 was talking about how she loves playing rookies because it's just so easy to just pull one over on them. She just loves killing them. She is somebody who she spoke at Kobe Bryant's memorial at crypto.com. I think it was Staples Center back then. It should always be Staples Center. And she managed to get in a dig at LeBron while he was giving her speech. Like this is something like that's generational levels of trolling and just being dedicated to the shit talk game. So that's just who she is. There's been a lot of discourse around pretty much, I feel like, with women's basketball becoming more popular, around the decorum around the game and this sort of expectation that these women should be more welcoming. Of course, like there's the Caitlin Clark aspect of it as well, but it's just a very strange thing to want some of the biggest competitors in the world to also be really polite people. Like, yeah. We love it. And we've loved the Anthony Edwards thing. And, you know, I think we would love it just as much if Kevin Durant went back at him. So it's been an interesting sort of, there's one thing that women's basketball gives you. It's discourse. Like anybody can take any player and make them a part of a larger cause. And you see, there's obviously like there's a huge Angel Reese aspect of all of this where we saw things get very, very nasty for her when she did like the "You Can't See Me" to Caitlin Clark. It's a strange, I think that as this sport becomes more mainstream, I think that there are going to be a lot of people that have to grapple with new realities and the way that the world is changing. And I mean, that's always the story perpetually, but it's an interesting canvas to see it all play out on.
Yeah. There's the push and pull of it's objectively a good thing to like have more focus and more attention and more money and more support and like raising the level of, you know, I guess just general sort of like the rising tide lifts all boats of, you know, more mm-hmm. eyeballs on the league. But when you open the door and you start letting everybody in, it brings with it some less fun elements of the bigger tent. And I think we've seen a ton of that over the years in men's sports. And there's a little bit of like, caveat emptor with some of that. But I think you're right. Like when we arrive at a point where no one's expecting people to be, you know, genteel ambassadors and they're willing to just let them be eating grandmotherfuckers, I think we'll all be in a better spot for sure.
Yeah, and that's why I love Caitlin Clark too. Like, it's the same sort of thing that attracts me to her that also attracts me to Diana Taurasi, because it's just a really fun thing to watch.
Yeah, like the you are watching some of the most sociopathically competitive people on earth do that, and like expecting something some other way around it is a fool's errand and less fun. Speaking of less fun, I'm going to ask you for something here. Question number 4. What is a take that you are willing to put on wax about the Tortured Poets Department?
Ooh, Joe Alwyn comes out looking really good here, in my opinion, because so few of the songs were about him. To me, that suggests a relationship that, you know, definitely over the course of time, as sometimes long relationships do, you have these cracks that turn into much, much bigger problems over time, but you're not as traumatized by them. Like, it's just a relationship that ran its course. He never, like, you can never, like, you can't make me hate him. He didn't seem like he was a bad guy. He seemed like he was the guy that she needed when she needed to, like, hide from the public, and he wanted a quiet life, and then she started feeling better and didn't want a quiet life, and that's what happens in lives, and everybody gets to make a choice and decide, okay, well, I still want this and I still want this, so maybe we part ways. So few, like the amount of songs that were about Matty Healy as opposed to him were suggestive of like, oh, this guy was the actual problem. There's also a lot of theories on TikTok about how maybe Matty and Taylor were a thing for quite a while. And it like overlapped through a number of relationships. And now I don't like, you never really know with that stuff, but it seems like maybe they were actually talking to each other through their records. That's my biggest takeaway from like the larger lore that came out of it. Album was fine. It was 31 songs. Katie Baker at The Ringer did like a staff round table. She called it a buffet. Like, you can't really call it, like, it's not really an album that you like everybody likes every song like start to finish, but maybe you can pick 5 or 6 that you're into,
right? You sort of curate your own version of the record from the department store. I like that. I also like the fact that it's like what is the most comfortable take, and it's like, it's fine, and then you have to worry, like, are you going to immediately be like swarmed upon by people saying, she said it's fine, all she said was that it's fine.
Yeah, I got called a misogynist for having an opinion about the album on Twitter a little while ago. So, you know, it comes with it.
Fun reality we live in. All right. Question number five. I have enjoyed your writing for a number of years. I think you know that, and we've talked about that. I think you write with a very distinct voice. You pull together turns of phrase that always make me happy. I read them. Divine Intervention is nothing if not a recommendation engine, admiration society. So I'm wondering, who are some of the writers that do that for you, where, you know, you read them and you're like, just the way they put sentences together or whatever, like you're always excited to see what that person has to say about X, Y, or Z things. Can be MBA, can be not, whatever.
So Lex Pryor wrote just one of the most awesome articles about Tom Thibodeau on The Ringer yesterday. And I, even if he wasn't working at The Ringer, I would just have to shout him out. I just think he's a brilliant writer, and he is simultaneously, like, he has a way of making sentences shimmer while also being accurate at the same time, which is just such a gift. And yeah, it's great, great piece about Thibodeau, and, you know, just like the taskmaster that he is, which you are obviously very familiar with. I've been enjoying more on the women's basketball side the work of Frankie De La Crita, who also puts out a great newsletter.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Absolutely. We go from the recommendation engine of writers we enjoy to a just general weekly recommendation. It's the last thing we do here on Divine Intervention. Can be about anything, just something you think is cool and good that the folks might enjoy. Examples in the past have included, like, Caitlin Cooper came on here and talked about Outshine Popsicles. People have talked about taking walks, going to the library. Rohan Notgurney came and talked about cooking dinner for somebody just to show them you care about them. Like, books, movies, TV shows as well, can be kind of whatever, anything that you think is cool and good. So, Sarah, do you have a recommendation for the people?
I really like the new Vampire Weekend album.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been really fun. It's like, it's probably like the most hopeful in its slant. Like, it probably like the sign of an aging writer as well. just sort of like, you know, starting to see the whole picture, patterns repeat themselves, but maybe, like, as we sort of cycle through things, we are still moving forward in our own just disgusting way. Like, I don't know if I'd go that far. I think, you know, things are kind of crumbling all over us, but, you know, nevertheless, we persist. Maybe we try to be more optimistic about the human spirit, our ability to persist somehow or just stay alive. But it's really an album. I like Mary Boone. I'm not a music critic by any means, and I say this because I'm just gonna say I love the way the album sounds, which is just the most I don't know how to be descriptive about music. It's something that I really admire in music critics. You know, even I think you did a great impression when you were talking about like before we got on the podcast of just like sound playback that happens when you record sometimes. Me personally, I just don't have the sentences to describe music, but maybe that's okay. Maybe it can stay in that place of like being magical and ineffable and indescribable for me.
Well, first things first, like, if whenever you start turning everything into something you have to have the right words for and it becomes work, then yeah, that can sap something from it. So if it's not just flowing out of you the way that you want to, then like, yeah, it's totally fine. Also, you work with like 1,000 music critics, so I think it's okay. You let them do that job. And you are with it. As far as evaluations of music goes, I like the way it sounds is a completely valid way to describe that. Like, that's,
it's,
you are well within your rights on
music,
that one.
So
yeah, right.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they're, you know, having a nuanced understanding of textures and, you know, key changes and whatever is fine, but also it'd be like, that fucking bangs, or like, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, exactly. The second half of Mary Boone is just fucking slaps. It's amazing.
there you go. Slaps, it bangs. Speaking of things that slap and bang, I'm aware this is threading a pretty fine needle.
Yeah.
Being inside Madison Square Garden when everything goes shit house, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It was weird, and the vibe was, as we mentioned it earlier, it was like, oh my God, are they going to lose this game? Oh man, what does this mean? What does this mean? And then three things happen, and it is the loudest place I've ever been, and I'm sitting on press row section 215, looking over the court, and everything starts moving. The floor is moving up, and like I feel it moving up and down.
Oh my God.
Because of how everyone is shaking and screaming. And I'm like, now Madison Square Garden is not a new building, but it is also a sturdy building, I've imagined. So for it to start vibrating, like literally I felt my, like the, and I don't think I was just having an out of body experience. I'm pretty sure there was a tactile component to it, like a physical space happening. It was shaking. And I'd never been someplace where that was happening before, outside of like being at like a rock show in a small dilapidated place where the floor literally was moving up and down. That happening in like a 20,000 seat arena at a basketball game is not something I ever anticipated I would feel. And it is I'd be lying if I said I haven't been kind of thinking about it for the last 14, 16 hours, whatever. And so being in a place where something that overwhelming happens is something, you were talking about not necessarily knowing if you have the words for it. I don't cover games on site a ton because that's not the version of this job that works best for my family. I've got two little kids and I got to be home for picking them up and I have a lot of stuff that I got to do around here. But when you get out to someplace and something like that happens, it is like, oh, well, that's why people gather. Mm-hmm. Like that is why a large number of people go to the same place to try to feel something. And that is what it was. And now I don't, there's lots of other people who are not happy about the feelings of that, many of them living in Philadelphia. But if you are able to be in a place that has that kind of moment, it made me think of the band Warriors and a song called WTF is Sleep, which I've recommended on this show before. There's a line in that song that says, you miss out on energy, you get somewhere else. You'll feel better if you leave the house. And that is what I thought about being there. I'm like, had I just been like, I can't make it tonight, I would not have experienced this thing that I think is a feeling and a vibration that is probably going to be stuck somewhere in between my ears for as long as I have them. So go be wherever your version of Madison Square Garden when Dr. DiVincenzo hits a three is. I hope you go find it and commune in that place with a lot of other people and enjoy that moment.
That's really poignant and beautiful, Dan. Wow. Thank you. Wow. You also tangibly made a decision that I was mulling a lot easier today because I was trying to figure out, I'm writing tonight and I'm like, am I going to the Clippers Mavericks game? Or like there's also Suns Timberwolves going on. Maybe it's a better night to watch things from home, but I think I have to go after hearing that.
I think if you got the opportunity, I could be, and now I would have had no, you know, obviously had no idea what was going to happen or that would have been an outcome there, but like, you don't put yourself in position. Yeah, you can't reap the benefits of the possibilities. So
exactly. The Isaiah Hartenstein offensive rebound and the practicing of that possibility.
That's right. So, hearing all those guys after the game talk about like what was going through your mind, and all of them had like a complete like pinhole, like super fine point, like get the ball, get the steal, get the ball. See stick, go fetch. You know, there's that thing, that component of it. As now we've weaved dog ownership through all of this show. So I'm very glad that I left the house last night. And I'm very glad that I came back so that I could have this conversation today with you, Sirat Sohi. I want you to check out all of Sirat's wonderful writing on The Ringer. Sirat, is there anywhere else that you'd like to point people on our way out the door?
No. I will say there's just so much fantastic writing going on in general, like despite the fact that the industry itself is crumbling and we just sort of like constantly play this game of musical chairs where, you know, the new ownership comes in, they decide they're going to change everything, and then some other company just hires all the talented people that they let go of, and that's very stressful for the people that go through it. And I wish it didn't happen, because if there's anything we've learned from that, it's that stop trying to reinvent the wheel, just let talented people do their thing. Which actually, you know, to that point, Katie Heindel, who just kind of lost one of her big freelance gigs at Dime Up Rocks, runs just one of the best Substacks called Best Basketball Feelings. That is also just essential reading. One of the most unique writers about basketball. I would read Katie on anything, but just having her voice over the last few years has been so important, and also beyond important, just enlightening and fun, and has made me a better writer and a sharper thinker. So yeah, shout out to her, and subscribe to her Substack, because if you like great independent creators, I think we're going to a place where you kind of have to support them directly.
You're right. and Katie is wonderful. And I firmly, I second that emotion. And also, what generosity of spirit from you that you're like, given the opportunity to plug something else, I'm going to plug someone else. Really speaks well of you, Sirat. I think that's a very, very cool vibe from you.
That's what I was going for, actually. Yeah, that was a play that I was making. And I'm glad that you saw it and recognized it. I just, you know, it's like expert manipulation. And yeah, you spend enough years on this earth, you get good at those types of things.
I was going to say the older version of you dominates the younger version of you when it comes to manipulating plugs at the end of podcasts.
Yeah, see, younger version of me would have plugged something that I was working on, but now that I've plugged somebody else, it's going to make your listeners more interested in what I'm doing.
That's exactly right.
And the fact that I said all this won't change any of that at all.
Yeah, right? Totally. Chestnut checkers. You got to read the game. That is going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. Thank you so much to Sirat Sohi for taking all this time to be with us. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. Vinny Goodwill and Tom Haberstroh, the aforementioned, will be back with a new episode of The Good Word tomorrow. And Jake and I will be back with No Cap Room on Thursday here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed, which... if you made it this far and you've dug it, rate us, review us, subscribe, 5 stars, all that. Help us with discoverability of the show. Tell a friend, tell an enemy. I think that's about it. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.